Hi, and welcome to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast. Each week, we talk with patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, or healthcare professionals and do what Cure does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. Before listening to this podcast, please note that it contains a personal account of the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York City that may be unsettling or triggering. Listener discretion is advised. Dr. Michael Crane watched in horror from Long Island City as the second World Trade Center tower fell on September 11th, 2001. In that moment, he decided he would do everything he could to help the situation. Today, he works as medical director of the Selikoff Centers for Occupational Health of the World Trade Center Health Program Clinical Center of Excellence at Mount Sinai. Crane is an expert on the physical and mental health impacts of the September 11th attacks on rescue and recovery workers and shared some insight on the latest research and concerns for these individuals in this episode of the Cure Talks Cancer podcast.
Let's just delve down to the nitty-gritty, if you will. So what is it about the exposure to the air around Ground Zero shortly after 9/11 happened that increases a person's risk for cancer?
In the first place, it was the collapse of a large building with lots and lots of building materials in it and other parts of plastics and metals, et cetera, that parts of computers that we don't even know about. So all that was ground into pulverized dust. And on top of that, it was on fire. And we know that combustion products, particularly of some building materials, can throw off an awful toxic exposure. So there are actually two things going on, the combustion and the pulverization of this in two enormous structures. And I'm sure you've seen the pictures of the folks just walking up the street from being downtown during the time of the collapse. And they were covered with, they looked like plaster statues. They were covered with dust. So the dust literally got into their clothes, into their lungs, into their mouths. It was choking. It was blinding. And the responders who ran down there continued that exposure for months at a time. So it was a massive ongoing exposure.
Do we know how long that exposure could increase a person's risk for cancer? Because, obviously it was in the air for months and months. Could it be about a year, less than a year? Do we have no idea?
Well, okay, let me be honest with you. We actually have no idea because we don't really know what was in the mix of what any individual person what inspired. But we do know some of the components that were there, like asbestos, which is a classic lung toxin. And the effects of asbestos can be felt well beyond 20 years. There is, in fact, a cancer called mesothelioma, which appears in asbestos workers 40 to 45 years after exposure. So it's a very long-term exposure trail just for one toxin that was definitely down there, much less the ones we don't even really know about.
So are there certain types of cancer that a patient or a person who was exposed to the air may be more prone to developing than others, or is it kind of a widespread cancer risk?
Also, excellent question. Yes, there are greater predispositions because if, for example, you breathe certain types of particles, the particles of a certain size may layer out in the lung, and they may go no further, or they may migrate to the lining of the lung, like asbestos does sometimes. But yes, it can be absorbed into the body, it can stay in the lungs, it can be eaten and swallowed and get out of the digestive tract. So the physical properties of the dust mixed with fumes and vapors from fires made this an extraordinarily dangerous exposure.
Are there any estimates out there about how many people the air exposure has affected, obviously going beyond the victims themselves, but rather first responders, survivors, et cetera, who did eventually develop cancer?
Just everyone down there has to be assumed to have been exposed just by the look of the place after the collapse. And we know that the dust got into, air conditioning vents and inside people's windows, and people went back to their offices and there was, 3 inches of dust in the middle of their desk. And that was over on Wall Street. So this was a very, very diffuse and massive exposure, plus all the stuff we don't know about that got away into the air. So that's why when, I guess, the government was trying to figure out, okay, who was exposed here, they really took the whole responder population, who were definitely exposed because they were digging in the stuff and therefore aerosolizing it and breathing it. But the also the all the people who lived in the community around there, who had, anyone who had an open window or a broken window or an open ventilation duct, which was practically everybody in a warm September afternoon, was exposed to this material. So I think correctly, the people who tried to do this took the broad view and say, well, it's this everyone in this population center here. Here's the area where we think the dust was. And for the community folks, the folks who went to school down there or worked down there or owned a candy store or a dry cleaner down there, that was felt to be most of lower Manhattan going over into Brooklyn. And that was like 400,000 people, so a huge population. And then the responders just kept on coming, came from everywhere, every state. Literally every district in the House of Representatives of the United States has a responder from that area who came to World Trade. So they were easier to count. Of course, in the confusion, there was no real roster kept for a long, long time. So some people came and left, and we're left with these estimates of, okay, we think it was 90,000 responders. But to say that if you were down there, if you lived down there, you were exposed, if you were in that zone, I think that's entirely accurate.
You got me thinking, because you mentioned that a lot of the particulate was on people's clothes, they breathed it in, etc. But is there such thing as secondhand exposure to the asbestos and all this?
Oh, sure. Actually, it's a great point you bring up, because back with that same asbestos literature, there's a very well-documented instances of, for example, the wives of the either construction or asbestos workers who came home with their work clothes on. That exposure, you know, the spouse back in the day, being the one who would do the laundry, mm-hmm. having that exposure and being exposed to the clothes. Some of those, and they were mostly women, of course, came down with mesothelioma. So, yes, there's a definite history and a lore, actually, within the field of occupational medicine that be careful with dust exposures, because sometimes the kids and the people at home are also exposed. And it's actually a big deal, particularly in things with lead workers and stuff, when they come home with lead dust on their clothes and little kids are, you know, still crawling around on the floor, they can get a good dose of lead. So it's really in the occupational medicine literature and lore. And in this case, because of the way this stuff spread, it was definitely in the homes and in the apartments and everywhere in downtown Manhattan.
Now, Dr. Crane, I'm going to go a little bit on a personal level.
Okay.
Were you downtown or anywhere nearby New York City on 9/11?
Yes. When the attack came, I was driving into work. I was the medical director of Con Edison at the time. And I was driving into work and I was coming in just up to the viaduct, which leads to the Midtown Tunnel mm-hmm. on the Long Island Expressway. And everything stopped. All the cars stopped. And really stopped for a long time. And I don't know if you know the Long Island Expressway, but it's not unusual for everything to stop because of accidents or what have you. So everything stopped, and finally people began to get out of their cars and walk around, and I was trying to, I don't know what I was doing, not paying attention. But eventually I noticed everybody had the radios on, and they were playing loud, and then we heard about this plane that had crashed into the tower, and oh, it was terrible. And we're standing there, and cars moved a little bit, and it was really time dragging on. And then the word came about a second plane, and that was really it. I mean, it just changed the complexion of everything from possible accident to some sort of, you know, attack. And I managed to back up right into Long Island City there on the east side of the East River. And there was a company headquarters building there, training center. And I was able to get in and, you know, talk to people, figure out what was going on. And you had people calling their daughters or husbands and in the building and then saying, oh, they're getting out. And then I went upstairs to the top of the building. And just as I got there, the tower number two collapsed. And I see it, and I see it today. I can see it in my mind's eye. It's right there, a little bit off to the right, watching its thing just balloon out into fire and then disappear. And that was it. That was a really emotional moment for me. And I promised that I would do anything to make this situation better. And guess what happened? At the time, it was just, it was crushing just to watch that. It's just like, oh, God, you know, how can that be? To see that and obviously lives destroyed right before your eyes. Yes, and so many, I didn't personally lose anybody close to me in the towers, but many, many, many other people I know did, and I knew the family members, and it was a very tragic time. And then you sound a little bit young to remember this, but the New York Times put photos of all the people who had died a series of their newspapers over the course of several weeks. And it was amazing. Everybody knew somebody who had passed away at sea. It was remarkable, the kinship and the acquaintanceship within this huge city of ours. So it was a terrible time of grief, a lot of anger about the attacks. And then Con Ed workers began coming in with the cough right away as soon as the response started, because they were part of the response to, you know, hook up emergency electric lines and turn off steam lines and gas lines and do inspections. So they were getting sick. And then we started Beth Israel Medical Center, the wonderful doctors there. And then because I was connected with Mount Sinai as a kind of a training site for their residency, I began to talk more with the Sinai faculty about what they were doing. And they were going to build a program because they had figured out that the exposure was going to be very bad. And then there's actually managers from the company that I was working for, Con Ed, came to me and said, you've got to help the workers. There's something going on. They're not themselves. They're depressed. They're angry. So we started a mental health program. We put the folks to visit the workstations and go out and give therapy sessions out there. And my colleague, Dr. Joanne DeFiti from Cornell, eventually wrote it up. And got it published, and it really demonstrated tremendous impact of PTSD and depression brought about by this event, and to other workers as well, not just the ones I was working with. It was also noted by colleagues up at Sinai and all the other centers. So mental health issues were part of the distress brought by the World Trade attacks, literally from day one.
So you mentioned a lot of your work that ensues in Mount Sinai. So why do you think centers like the World Trade Center, Health Program Clinical Center of Excellence, and others that are around are so important to have in place?
Well, I mean, just historically. So the predecessor of our programs was the Selikoff Center, which was founded by Dr. Irving Selikoff, one of the great asbestos researchers. And he had also started an occupational medicine residency, which trained the whole generation of occupational health physicians who were there and on duty when the towers came down. And they had been studying exposures in industry and environmental exposure their entire professional lives. And the urban legend is, and this is, I can't absolutely swear to this, urban lore is that just like me, three of those doctors working at the time couldn't get into the city either. And they didn't live that far from each other in Westchester. And they met at the house of one of them, and they sketched out not only the illnesses that they'd expect from the responders, but the entire medical response that they thought would, you know, need to be created to meet the challenges of this exposure. And so the lore is that they pretty much outlined the Zadruga Act of 9/11 itself. Now, grains of salt everywhere, right? But it just shows you that, you know, the people who have training in this area really were able to see right away that this was going to be a terrible event and require a long-term response.
So let's fast forward to current day. Obviously, we're a few days away from the 20th anniversary, and unfortunately, many people have received diagnoses of cancer related to 9/11 and its air exposure. But what still concerns you to this day?
So the clock has not stopped running. The biggest fear that I had, because I had done some asbestos work myself, not to the extent that the Selikoff team did, but I was very concerned about that kind of 20-year time frame for asbestos making or causing cancer in asbestos workers. And there was tons of asbestos released when the towers came down. So from that point of view alone, I was really terrified that there's going to be an epidemic of lung cancer among the responders and among the community. And that has not happened. Really, when you look at the data, the incidence and prevalence of lung cancer are not greater in responders. In fact, it's a bit lower in responders than in the regular population of New York State, not just New York City, New York State. And I think the reason for that is that from day one, the World Trade Center people and the World Trade Center program stressed and stressed and stressed, don't smoke, stop smoking, and provided assistance to do so. And today, the population smoking rate is very low. So it could be that by pulling away that extra toxin, that voluntary toxin that people were smoking, we may have helped them, you know, dodge this big bullet that was coming at them. Now, does that hold out for the next 10 years or next 20 years? You know, I hope so, but I need to be sure about that. So we're going to continue with things like our lung screening programs and our advice about, you know, avoiding pulmonary toxins and avoiding carcinogens to make sure we keep this population safeguarded. Other thing that's happening is that there's been some good research about the program itself. This just came out. There's an article, I think it's the American Journal of Industrial Medicine, which all the programs combined their data and demonstrated that survival from cancer that has been diagnosed in World Trade Center folks is better than that in the general population. In other words, mortality from cancer for World Trade Center responders who are in the World Trade Center program is lower than those folks who are, you know, treated or than the general population in the community. And to me, that's very significant because it looks for all the world like the program is doing what it was supposed to do, you know, preventing that. But the other thing we have to be sure about is that it's not just an impact of the so-called healthy worker effect. In other words, workers who are down at World Trade are like firemen, right? Are super healthy people, climbing ladders and doing all this stuff. So does that translate into no matter what toxin hits them, they do a better job of fending it off and don't really have the answer to that? But right now, it looks like the World Trade Center program is doing something right. And we have to keep testing that, keep trying to do the right thing by repeating that study in 5 years and doubling down on the prevention programs that we had. But at least we have some evidence now that we seem to be doing something.
Well, Doctor, those are all the formal questions that I prepared, but I wanted to see if there was any closing thoughts, anything you wanted to mention before we finish up.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to sit in on an interview, a TV interview, with a police officer who had gotten sick. And this guy, just a really, really brave and good man. And he's doing well in the program. And I just watched that for a while, and I was asked to say a few things. But I am so grateful that I have the opportunity to help that person and people like that. It's an honor. It just is an honor. These are heroes.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cure Talks Cancer podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.